Assalamualaikum. I'm Yasin Bonds, and this is the Muslims Connected podcast, a podcast for those looking to enrich and empower themselves. Today, we are joined by none other than the such a big title I need to add for this man, for this uncle, I'll say, Mr. Imtiaz Suleiman. Shukran for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much. And Ramadan Mubarak to you and to all your viewers.
Shukran also for your time. I feel like you're a very busy man. When do you find rest?
Well, my wife laughs. I tell him, rest is stressful for me. Yeah. But I mean, I do get late at night. I sleep three to 4 hours a night. So I work most of the time, you know, but that 3 to 4 hours is a very good sleep because your soul is very satisfied, you're contented. And, you know, when you're done, you know, that 3 to 4 hours is going to be very valuable. And of course, there are days that when I'm on a mission, it'll be 3 to 4 days that I won't sleep at all.
Wow.
Yeah. And especially when you're on a mission and there's time zones differences, you have to be working with your teams on the ground.
Yeah.
But you've got officers in different parts of the world that's waiting for messages from you, or they want you to respond to them. So it's very hard to sleep in those kind of situations. But I mean, it's years now. It's something my body is trained for. And also, I think from small, from my hometown, Potchefstroom, we say it's a Suleiman disease, you know, where sleeping is not part of our blood. Moving and working all the time. My aunties, as old as they are, they come from Potchefstroom to Durban. They'll come 11 o'clock at night in the old days. They're ready to go out, you know, and late at night, at that age when it was much more safer and secure. And I mean, they're 70, 75 years old.
And still going strong.
And going strong. It was that kind. And the children and the grandchildren are exactly the same. They don't know what sleep is all about. They want to go out all the time.
On the move.
Yeah.
But so you spoke about, I'll say home. As a child, you are now a leader, a community leader, a world leader as well. Where did you first, I'll say, find leaders that empowered you and gave you the confidence to become a leader?
It's not something that I studied or learned. You know, to be honest, my background is very spiritual, okay? But before that phase, when you learn from people, it's not about leadership, it's about emulation, right? It's not about wanting to be a leader. There was never a case of wanting to be a leader. It was about wanting to do good, which is very different. And then the first person, of course, was my parents. My father and we were a history of a family business. We come from Potchefstroom. It's a small town. Your great-grandfather is a trader. My grandfather joins him. My father joins him. I join them. You know, it's that kind of stuff. And then the next generation joins whilst we're there. But it's how they did their business which set an example. So let me give you a clear message. Mm-hmm. We got all black customers. They buy on account. They buy food, clothing, mostly. They would come and they'll say, we can't pay the account, but our children are hungry. So my grandfather would say, give them the food. They're not going to be able to pay us. But they've been our customers for so many years. And before that, their family was our customers. It's fine, we're not going to get paid. Same people or somebody else would come and say, we haven't paid the account, but we've got to bury somebody, we've got a funeral. And my grandfather and my father would say, it's a case of dignity. We're never going to get the money back, but they've been our customers for a long time. And they would give them the money to help for the funeral. And when you looked at that, you'd see the humanity come out from your family. Learning all Islamic teaching and living Islamic teaching is two different things.
Yeah.
My mother and my father got separated. She was from Durban originally. She went back there. She started an employment bureau. And she said the best thing you can do to give people dignity is to find them jobs. So she ran an employment bureau and she started finding people jobs. And they would come and they would cry. And they would say, we've been battling for so long. Thank you very much. I'm now independent. And she said it's so important to help people find their dignity and find themselves because they're breadwinners. I mean, some men get jobs for men and for ladies both. And then she would tell me, every month we must go give a food parcel, even if it's only one. She wasn't of much means when she went back to Durban. I left Potch to join her many years later. And she said, even if it's one food parcel, but we must do it every month. And you need to find the people out because the real ones that need it won't come out to ask. So she started off with one food parcel, then two food parcels, and then five food parcels. So it was all about, you can't help everybody, but whatever you do consistently and make sure you seek the people out. And we found, you know what, that is Islamic teaching. The Prophet ﷺ said that whatever you do, even if it's a small amount, but be consistent in what you do. So those were the family messages. And of course, beyond that, the caring. The caring, everybody in the family takes care of everybody. But if you go beyond the family, and I'm explaining because these are life's issues that we need to know now, that the community, there was community parenting.
Yes.
So if I did something naughty, you know, and the neighbor like 10 houses down the road will come and tell my father, your son did this, that, and the other. And my father said, why didn't you give one tight slap? You know, right? And it wasn't about corporal punishment.
Yeah.
It was about disciplining you. And my father would say, and every member of every house would say, your child is my child. And that way, that slap was worth it. Mm-hmm. Because you kept on the straight path.
Yeah.
You never got lost. Today's kids are all lost. Today you tell the parent, your child is doing this. They tell you, shut up, mind your business, got nothing to do with you. The ego and arrogance has taken over, but the destruction of the kid, and then 15 years later, they're sobbing and they're crying and want to go to this Molana and that Imam and to pray by this place. It's the law of life. You didn't take care of it when you're supposed to take care of it. When you were getting help and guidance, you got too arrogant. It's something you need to know. And the new generation that watches this program need to know to discipline your kids from an early age. No ego, no arrogance. They're doing you a favor, you're not doing them a favor.
Yes.
Right? And you found that everybody grew up in the right way. The moment the system changed, kids got lost along the way. So community involvement was very important. What's missing again is the love. You see, in that small town, in the old days, if somebody got married, you were not offended, you were not invited. You can't invite everybody. But the whole town would come to set up the tables. And those days, they weren't in this ceramic place. You know, you just roll the paper out, throw the cardboard, and you fly it across the thing, and everybody sets it up quickly, in and out, clean up fast. Set up the old type wooden trestles.
Yeah, yeah.
And people would come and help. If there's a funeral, the whole town comes to help. You know, okay, now your husband passed away, you mustn't cook, you mustn't do this. We'll take care of you for the whole next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And people send the food from every house. Now that's not about leadership, but it's about community care, it's about courtesy, it's about humanity, it's about values, and it worked very well. I'm very happy that I grew up in Potchefstroom, you know. And then, of course, my father was involved in the Western Transvaal Tennis Union. And we have people come play tennis, they would come play soccer, they would come and play cricket, they would come from Rustenburg, from Lens, from Klerksdorp, from Bloemhof, you know, and those are the main areas they should come. But there were no like restaurant situations in those days. So everybody takes somebody to their home. So you don't go out to eat, you come to the home. And you find that you build a relationship with those people you don't even know who they are. But they've come from some other town, and every time it's not the same people, it's different players. But they come to your house. And when you go to their town, it's the same thing. So that sense of community across that time, you know, it was Transvaal. It wasn't Northwest and Gauteng and Limpopo and Mpumalanga. It was just Transvaal. And people would come from the different areas. So you learned all these values in the town. And the final one that made me do medicine was the family doctor. You know, Dr. Ismail Hafiji. He passed away now, maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come, house call, always smiling. He was excellent as a professional, as a doctor, but he had a special empathy about him and a care about him that he would take good care of you and he wouldn't complain whether it's night, weekend, after hours, and he would always heal when he would see you. He was my parents' doctor. He delivered me.
Ooh.
And he was my doctor.
Wow.
Right? And I won't forget one day, he was also Hafiz. So that was another thing, you know, inspired. I said, doctor, I'll become Hafiz part business. I don't know too much about that one, but the doctor part, I'm interested in following this doctor. And every Ramadan, again, in a small town, in old days, you had a shortage of Hafiz in a small Ufaz, you know, in a small town.
Mm.
And he would get up for Ramadan and lead the prayer for Taraweeh. And 1 year he said, look, he needs to take a break. He's really tired. So they said, okay, we'll try to find somebody from some other town. But now the production line had increased, right?
Yeah.
So he said, nobody came. So the people are sitting in the mosque. They said, okay, we'll read, you know, from Alam Dara, kind of a short one every day. He got up, went to the front. He said, I'll do it. And he just got up and he did it. For the whole town.
Just stepping up,
you know, he had a sense of responsibility. He was a spiritual healer and a physical healer. and he led by example, and always smiling. Eventually went to Durban, he studied further after many years, became a specialist in pediatrics, and then became a professor.
Wow.
You know, and he was excellent. That same care that he had, the same humility, even being a professor, earning much more, never changed the man. You know? And whenever you see him, he greets you like he greeted you when you were in Pontius room. So those were people you looked up to. It molded you. It wasn't about leadership. Mm. I keep emphasizing, it's not about leadership. It's about molding your personality and learning from other people. And the background was absolutely phenomenal for me.
And so then you studied medicine, became?
Well, before that, I went. Oh. Then I went to Durban.
Okay.
Because remember, there was only one medical school here we could go to, right? For the Blacks Medical School, UKZN, it was called Natal Medical School. You know, that's all. It wasn't Nelson Mandela at that time. And so I went to Durban because my mother was there. I did standard 7, grade 9 today's times,
okay,
in Orient Islamic School, but they didn't have S7. So I couldn't do science. So all the kids used to move either to Sussex College or to Gandhi Desai. We moved, my whole team moved to Sussex College. But when I came to Durban the first time, in the streets where I was living, there were gangsters. They were all gangsters in Carlisle Street, Beater Street, Warwick Avenue. And I would see these guys just fighting with each other, poke each other in the neck. And I'm thinking, where the hell did I come to? You know, there's all mad people living in this place, you know. And they just get off on the roads, get out of the cars and start fighting with each other. And there they start talking about bush knife and panga and screwdrivers and all. And I'm thinking, what the hell?
From Poch to Durban,
a huge shift. And the first day I go to school, the PE teacher says, I don't know what they say, PE teacher, physical training, physical education, I don't know what words they use these days. But the PE teacher says, we're going to run around the race course. Because I used to live in Carlisle Street, the race course was across my house, and the school was across the race course too. So he said, we're going to run around the race course. I said, you mean the horses are going to run in the race course? He said, no, we're going to run in the race course. I'm thinking, what's wrong with this guy? How are we going to run around the race course?
And then, long track also.
Yeah, I think it was 3.2 kilometers.
Wow.
And I did it, and then the first time when I finished off in the top few, I couldn't believe I did it. And I suddenly developed a love for running around the race course because I just loved it. Yeah. I was never involved in sports. Yes, I went with my father to Western Transvaal, helped with all the admin stuff, played some tennis in Poch, never played any other sports. And here I come to Durban in this case, it's street sports, like the old days. Mm. You play soccer on the road, you hit the ball on the road, you play cricket on the road, you do everything on the road, right? Because you've got nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So I started playing. And I remember when I started playing soccer, they were laughing at me. They said, like, I'm the reserve ball boy, not even the proper ball boy, a reserve ball boy, right? And then eventually grew up and became like a substitute. And the following year, I became the captain of the side.
Wow.
And I got determined. And then when you see all these kids playing, and you see some of them playing barefoot, you know, and you get this determination to play. And then I got involved in tennis, table tennis, volleyball, soccer, cricket, snooker, swimming, athletics, cross country, squash, you know.
The whole Olympics.
The whole shoot. And in Ramadan, morning soccer, afternoon squash, evening tarawih, kind of stuff. But again, it was about the company that you had. Mm. It was these kids. They were not rich kids. They were just very ordinary kids, you know, who just loved life. And you joined them, you got something very different, and your life was molded. And I just met some of them again now. To me, my greatest joy is to meet those people from my Carlisle Street days, you know. And of course, when I meet my family from Poch's room. Yeah. Last year, we had a family reunion in Poch's room. 140 of us met.
Wow.
But all the old people are gone. You know, all my old family is all passed on. They're finished. They're gone. A town is not, does not have the noor and the light when the old people are gone. You know, you just feel so sad when you go there. You go to the graveyard, it's full. All the family and the old people that you knew. So yes, I met people from my school just recently. I met them from Carlisle Street, you know, and they lived in town. But they also molded me because we had camaraderie. Mm. On the field, we stood together. And we used to go by a bus. So we went bus to medical school, went bus to the soccer ground, did everything we did by bus. And we used to walk from Carlisle Street, right past Grey Street Mosque, towards a place called Albert Park, you know, where we used to play soccer at night, on a Friday night. Nice. And then we started medical school, and then eventually my father got me a car. My car was 1,700 rand, 50 rand for the radio, Yeah, you can't buy a tie for that price today. Yeah. And you know,
for the week.
Yeah. And then we used to go over the cars and we all used to share. And then after that, we should go to the restaurant and eat together. You know, those are the kind of things that I miss in today's world. You know, it's just so about yourself. Mm. It's about materialism. It's about, you know, technology and phones and TV. It's not about outgoing stuff.
Also, I feel like community nowadays is very competitive.
Yes.
People want to be better than each other.
Materially.
Yes.
You know? And a lot of people put themselves to debt. And I laugh. I said, a lot of people who got all this money doesn't belong to them. It's not an account, you know. But you don't worry about those things in those days. You know, you are competitive. You're going to do well in sports. Our team is going to win. And we're going to win the trophy. And you had the bigger teams. In Carlisle Street, we had many teams, not one. And the bigger guys will look after the smaller guys. And the smaller guys will look after the even smaller guys, kind of stuff. It was always about helping each other. It's never about money. Mm. Never about selfishness. Always about helping each other. Now, those are all the qualities you learned in life. When you think about it now, you imbibe all those things without actually learning it and say, okay, taxpayer, I got to be lead the person in a certain way. I got to follow this rule. I got to do A, B, C, and D. No, you learn in the ground. And gift of the givers is like that. You can't learn anything in the office. You learn everything in the field. You want to specialize in disasters, you come in the field. Where else is not going to teach you anything?
So what made the change then from, I'll say, medicine to humanitarian?
Gift of the givers is not my organization. I didn't get up one morning and say to myself, I think today I'll form an organization. I already had three practices. I'd moved from Durban to Maritzburg in 86. In 84, my mother passed on. And, you know, we didn't have much money. Then in 85, internship came. I was earning 999 rand a month. They end up at 45,000 rand today or more for the same thing. I'm thinking, we got left out. Right? And so I got married. In 84, 6 months later, my mother passed on. And I wanted to do, whilst I was internship, I wanted to specialize in medicine, internal medicine. But you know, we didn't have much opportunities those days. So there was no post. And I was forced to change. And then my father-in-law said, why don't you come to Maritzburg? Find some place here and we start some practice. And I went to Maritzburg and I found a place and I started a practice. And then you battled a lot and then drove out, went to outlying areas, you're still battling. And eventually, I got a practice in the second place and a practice in the third place in Maritzburg. And I ran three practices. And suddenly, when they really peaked, then the South African guy tells me about a Sufi Sheikh in Turkey. And you need to go there. So he tells me that in 86, when I moved to Maritzburg, he moved to Maritzburg in 86. The same week that I got there, the same week he got there. And my neighbor was a butcher. You know, this African guy came to buy meat from him. And he tells him, do you know any doctor? So the neighbor said, my neighbor is a doctor. So I met him and we spoke. It's a long story. But he told me, you need to go to Turkey. So I joked. I said, Mullah, it's 1986. I haven't been to Cape Town yet. When am I going to ever get to Turkey? So he said something very profound. He said, what God wills happens. African guy telling me that. He said, there's a time and a place. In 91 August, my wife and I landed up in Turkey. It's a long story. But we landed up in Turkey. And when we walked inside there, the life perceptions again, the more we walked inside there, the learning started without anybody saying anything. This is post-Gulf War. And remember, the world got polarized. Mm-hmm. East on one side, West on one side, Christians, Hindus, and Muslims on one side, Christians, Hindus, and Jews on one side, Muslims on the other side. And Samuel Huntington spoke of the clash of civilizations in those days. And I walk inside here with my wife, and we're totally stunned. Americans, Russians, people from Europe, Sweden, Norway, Germany, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, Southeast Asia, Africa, all in a Muslim holy place. Jews, Christians, Hindus, you know, mixed people of other religions, and people say we don't even believe in anybody. All day. But no friction, no fighting, calm, everybody respecting each other. And we come from apartheid South Africa, didn't help. And I'm looking at all this, I say, how can this be possible? How is this ever possible? Nobody's saying anything to anybody in the supposed Gulf War. The Sufi Sheikh saw the shock on my face. And I told my wife, I think we're in the wrong place. How can this be possible? What's all these people doing here?
And they're all living fine together.
Well, they were there for the session. They were not living there. So they came together and talking peacefully. So the teacher asked me, translator, what do you see? So I said, I'm confused. What are all these people from different nationalities, sorry, and different countries doing in a Muslim holy place? We fought wars with them all over the world. And he said, my son, you see right. Sorry. Mankind is one single nation. The God of all mankind is one. We just call him by different names. And he said, and the bad behavior of an individual or a small group of people is not significant, is not symbolic of an entire nation. He said, people, the real religious law is to promote love, kindness, compassion, and mercy. And he said, see all these people here? They all believe in that. They all come from different traditions, but we all believe in one God. And that's what unites us. And that's the essence of religion. That mankind is one single nation, and we don't look for faults in people. When we see somebody doing something, evil is very different from a fault. Yes. Evil is just downright evil, like what you say in Israel today. Yeah. That's outright evil, that you can't solve. It's they said the sin of arrogance and ego, that you can't solve. But the sin of the flesh, adultery, drinking, gambling, pork eating, he said all those things you can fix. He said, those don't judge people. Your job is not to judge anybody. Your job is to judge yourself. So when people have bad habits, it doesn't make them bad people.
Yeah.
There's no saint on earth. Right? But outright evil, that's a different category altogether. That you can't fix.
Yeah.
Right? So he said that. And I looked at what he's saying. And I'm thinking to myself, yes, I've seen people. They have some bad habits, but so do I. Right? And why am I judging people according to when I should look, I got the faults myself. And immediately, the blink of vision went out. I'm not coming to South Africa to judge any white guy, Christian guy, Afrikaner guy. You know, because everybody was not responsible for apartheid. Because we had Afrikaner neighbors in Potchefstroom, and they were absolutely wonderful people. You know, and a lot of them felt very guilty about what was happening, but they just had to follow the rules. And I came back with an open mind. And suddenly everything changed. But what opened my mind more than anything else is his emphasis about all mankind being one nation. So I came back, my wife and I went for Hajj, outside the tomb of the Prophet. I'm standing there, I said, look, I'm a little confused. I saw this place of Sufism. I don't understand its role in Islam. I'm a little confused, but I fell in love with what I saw. So if it's meant for me, I need to go back there. Mm. Came back from Hajj, August, 6th, August 92, there was a reason for me to get back to Turkey. I go there, Thursday night, 10 p.m., immediately after the zikr program, the sheikh picks up his head, makes eye contact with me, and looks heavenward at the same time. And in fluent Turkish, and I don't speak a word of Turkish, but that night, I understood everything that he said in Turkish. He said, my son, I'm not asking you. I told you it's not my organization. I'm not asking you. I'm instructing you to form an organization. He gives the name. In Arabic, he says, the name will be Waqful Waqifin. Not exact translation, you know, we don't know in Arabic. So we came to the closest gift of the givers. You will serve all people of all races, all religions, all colors, all classes, all cultures, of any geographical location and of any political affiliation. But you will serve them unconditionally. You will expect nothing in return, not even a thank you. In fact, in what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life, expect to get a kick up your back. If you don't get a kick up your back, regard it as a bonus. Serve people with love, kindness, compassion, and mercy. And remember, the dignity of man is foremost. So if someone is down, don't push them down. Hold them, elevate them. Wipe the tear of a grieving child. Caress the head of an orphan. Say words of good counsel to a widow. These are free. They don't cost anything. Clothe the naked. Feed the hungry. Provide water to the thirsty. And in everything that you do, be the best at what you do. Not because of ego. Ego is destructive. But because you're dealing with human life, human emotion, human dignity, and human suffering. And he said, my son, he repeated, this is an instruction for you for the rest of your life. And then he said, don't forget the most important aspect, that whatever you do is done through you and not by you. No place for ego. 32 years, I'm a living example. There are things that people think that I do is not humanly possible.
Yeah.
There's always a higher hand guiding you. So you're coming to the aspect of leadership. It's nothing to do with leadership.
Mm.
Everything is spiritually guided, spiritually directed. Because the answer lies in the next part. I asked him, how come when you speak Turkish, I understand, and other people speak Turkish, I don't understand? He said, my son, when the hearts connect and the souls connect, the words become understandable. But that's not the answer to the leadership question. The answer to the leadership question is this. I asked him, what exactly am I supposed to do? I'm a doctor. I got 3 practices in a place called Pietermaritzburg in South Africa. And I mean, the kind of thing you speak about is huge. What is it? Orphanage, old age home, food parcel, feeding, warm clothes. What are you talking about? He told me one line. You will know. I will know what? What will I know? He said, you will know. Finish. And you will know. For 32 years, I do know. What to do, what not to do, what to touch, what not to touch. In fact, the moment I walked out of that place on 6 August 92, the same night it came to me, respond to the civil war in Bosnia. I went in the same month, not 3-5 months later, the same month, I went in all alone and took in 32 containers of aid into Bosnia. 3 months later, I took in 8 containers of winter items, the chill factor is minus 21 degrees. And the following year, we designed the world's first containerized mobile hospital. A world first, a product of South African technology and South African engineering. And all the young people watching this program, believe in your country. Believe in yourself. Believe in Africa. Don't believe in things in the north. We got the skill, we got the know-how, we got everything here. We did the world first. Built in South Africa and taken from Africa to Europe. So that when CNN filmed it on the 1st of February 94, they said, the South African containerized mobile hospital is equal to any of the best hospitals in Europe. But the message was August 8 to Bosnia, November 8 to Bosnia, 93 hospital to Bosnia. What's it telling me? That you are going to be a specialist in disasters.
Hmm.
You will know what to do. I knew then that disaster intervention was going to be the primary focus of Gift of the Givers. Whether it's a war zone, whether it's international, whether it's tsunami, earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, famine, whether locally or internationally, that's the focus going to be. And it came to me immediately. And then came home, started in my 12 square meter room. My 4 kids sleep there in the double bunks. The fax machine is there. Everything's done there. We put our own money, and me and the family, and we do everything from home. You know, I mean, no outside money.
Mm.
We start with our own money and we start the process. And then step by step it comes. Somebody comes, and then after 2 years, my wife kicked me out. She said, how can kids sleep in the room with a fax machine ringing in the middle of the night here? You must go, you know. So then I rent the place, expansion. Then I first time I have a staff. No staff before that. My first staff was in 95. One staff. After that, everything was then me and the family did. No car, nothing. No van, nothing. And slowly people come, you know, we're hungry. Can you give us something to eat?
Mm.
Then somebody would come, you know, I'm doing physiotherapy. There's only take 8 people for physiotherapy. I'm the only lady, I got no money. Okay, we need bursaries. People came home, spoke to my wife. They said, we need counseling help. She realized we need to set up a counseling service. So over a period of time, I said, we don't have disasters every day. Now we got this office. Mm. What are we going to do in the meantime? So stage by stage, it came, okay, do this project, that project, wheelchair, stationery, you know, and it came, grew step by step, feeding center, food parcels, giving water here, doing this day. And over a period of time, we designed 21 different categories of projects. But we mastered one before we took out number 2.
Yeah.
And in each progress, I mean, still it was not much stuff. It was slow, growing. And of course, for the first time, in 2004, it's the first time we had our first medical team. So from 92 up to 2004, there was no medical intervention. Yes, there was a hospital, but we gave to the people to run it themselves. We gave tents, blankets, food, medicines, all that kind of stuff, but no medical teams. for the first time in 2004 in the tsunami, we responded to Africa. In Sri Lanka, not a medical team, but we were the first team in the world in Sri Lanka to respond to the tsunami. And we were the first team in the world to respond to a place called Hafun in northeast Somalia. And there we took primary healthcare teams. And in August, in the following year, there was famine in Niger. We took in primary healthcare teams. October 8, 2005, there was the earthquake in Pakistan from Rawalpindi to Muzaffarabad. We took in primary healthcare teams, trauma teams, meaning orthopedic surgeon, general surgeon, ICU, anesthetist, you know, and post-op rehab specialist. Specialist is physiotherapy, we do spinal rehab. In 2009, our first visit to Gaza, we added trauma counselors. But we said we got a problem after that week in Pakistan. We're not first, because medicine is the second line. First is search and rescue. Mm. So it wasn't about leadership, it was about practicality. Do you want to get there first? You need search and rescue. So we built our own search and rescue team. And in 2010, when the earthquake hit Haiti, boom, we made the world first. 8 days into the earthquake, we pulled a lady out alive from the church, from the Catholic church, 64-year-old Anne Azizi. She comes out from the church alive after three hours of my team's pulled out. No oxygen, no food, no water, completely unmeasurable and a fractured hip. She comes out alive. And the first word she tells my team is, I love God Almighty. You've instilled hope in somebody several thousand kilometers away from a different faith. But that first visit in Istanbul of 91, of different faiths with respect to each other, was what made this practical and real. And the second words was, I love you. The essence of religion is love and service, not fighting, friction, discord. That is not religion. Religion, Allah teaches mercy and kindness and compassion all the time. So, a world first. And in 2012, when we went to Congo, Republic of Congo, where there was an explosion of an ammunition dump in the residential area, we had everything, all the above, plus we had our own dogs this time. Plus, we had medical equipment, search and rescue equipment, the normal tents, blankets, food, you know, bottled water, sanitary pads, diapers. But we had specialized search and rescue equipment. We're probably the only guys in Africa who's got it. You put the machine on the ground in 3 minutes. It's called the life locator. Mm-hmm. It will tell you in 3 minutes who's alive 10 meters under the rubble. We've got special video cameras to look into the rubble. We've got special audio, because you know when in an earthquake, there's so much noise outside.
Yeah.
But this equipment, we can hear the sounds inside while there's noise outside. And right now, we're busy upgrading the equipment. Wow. So we now design, in terms of leadership, we now got our own medical teams. We've got two medical heads. We've got search and rescue teams with their heads. We've got counseling teams with their heads. And each one is fully functional, but each one knows what everybody does. Mm. Because we have sessions to keep them going, to train them all the time.
So now that you, I'll say going back now to the beginning again, when you're growing staff, how do you empower and have your staff see the vision that you are also seeing to help, I'll say, to help others outside of the community?
I lead every mission. I mean, every, all in the field myself. Mm-hmm. I started off putting the stickers on the wall of the pictures. I started the fax machine myself. I packed the truck myself. I carried the maize meal on my back myself. I drove the van myself. I couldn't drive the truck. I drove the bucky myself. You know, I delivered the stuff myself. There's no part of the organization you can bluff me. I know exactly how many pallets go in each truck, how much stuff was in each pallet, how many pallets will fit in what size truck, all the logistics, everything. I don't do that anymore now.
Yeah.
So my son has taken over. You know, in 2017, well, 2016, he just came to his mother and he said he likes to join me. So I said, he's not feeling well. He better go check himself out. He doesn't know what I've done to the family. Does he want to destroy his family also? Like what I've done, I've messed the whole family up. Does he want to do the same thing? He said, yes, he wants to do it. So I hadn't been to the tariqah for a long time, because my sheikh passed away in 1999. I couldn't adjust my soul to connect with a new teacher. 17 years it took me. But I felt my teacher that passed on was more with me when he was passed on than when he was alive. So I just felt him everywhere. So I couldn't connect. Finally, in 2016, I get there. The new man, I know him, because he was the first disciple of my teacher. He was always there. Wonderful man. Absolutely wonderful man. But I just couldn't make the mind, the mental switch. Mm. Eventually, I get it 2016, after 17 years. And I tell him, first thing I said, my son wants to join me. He said, what took him so long? And I knew, he's going to join me. 2017 came. So in terms of organization itself, he came in with, he's an engineer, IT guy. You know, they got all these new young kids, they got all these new ideas. I don't understand half the things they even do. Yeah. So he came in, took over the logistics, came into the social media team. He said, in the house, social media is not going to work because everybody is expanding and there's so many new ideas. We need like a whole team to work. So we designed a social media team. We brought in a corporate team. We brought in an account team. We brought a logistics team. We brought warehouse managers. We brought CLOs, which is community liaison officers, the guys that go in the field, that work on site with the people. But at every disaster, I was there. So, and then we have meetings for them. We address them. We brief them. We bring all the staff together once a year, from the whole country. Wow. They come here, and sometimes they come from other countries too. We bring them here. We brief them. But we're on, because now with WhatsApp and, you know, communication systems and Zooms, you can address everybody. So you suddenly in the middle of the year, we decide, okay, I think we need to talk to somebody now. We'll set up a session for the whole staff, inside and outside. So it's ongoing training, and they see the values. They listen to all the my talks, you know, the videos, the interviews. They would be on the field when I'm with them. And the teacher said, again, it's a spiritual thing, that you will never look for the people. They will always find you. 90% of the people who were employed, they came to us. We didn't have to look for them. Somebody would say, like, 2 weeks ago, you know what, I'm looking for a truck driver job. And 2 weeks later, we need a truck driver. It just happens like that all the time. That's why I say people think I do all these magic things. It's not magic. It's totally spiritual. He said, you will never look for money. As a policy, we don't have fundraisers. We don't ask people for money. People ask us what you guys do. What do you want money for? But you won't phone people, make an advert, pay for an advert, you know, do this, that, and the other, and say, please, we need money. We'll say, you're interested? This is the project. This is what we're doing. And sometimes people will phone and say, please, can you do that project? I'm going to give you $500,000. That kind of stuff. Wow. And we say, no, we're not doing this project now because it means putting a team, because I could tell you how I spend your money.
Yeah.
And we can't do that. Sorry. You know, I can't do that now. If we can't fulfill a project from start to end, we will not take your money. Our reputation is built on delivery.
It's all the love. It feels like the life lessons that you've learned in your early days have now...
No doubt. Everything is based on from where I came. And all the things came. I started running the High School Affairs Committee of the MSA. And we were absolutely methodical. We printed our own newsletters. We taught Arabic. We taught maths. I didn't teach the maths. Somebody else taught the maths. I wasn't so good, right? And taught them English. We taught them values. Taught them Islamic teachings. Taught them Quran. You know, a whole lot of different things. How to be disciplined. How to run a camp. How to organize tournaments. All the admin skills. Learning to run an organization. All that, you know. Got involved. Assisted the Islamic Medical Association. Got involved in governing bodies. I was the head of 120 governing bodies in KZN, you know, plus the head of my own school governing body, working with teachers. Then you learned about diplomacy, you know, human relations, you know, HR, all that kind of stuff. Subliminally, all those things come to you, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the media interview started coming. And then you learn how to engage to the media. I've been doing this for 32 years for the media, you know.
You've done, I'll say, many countless jobs. What was of the first interaction that you've had that reaffirmed what you're doing is the right thing?
The Bosnia hospital. Well, I didn't need the reaffirmation. I made up my mind the moment the teacher gave me the instruction. The moment I saw that man's face, I fell in love with somebody I don't even know, from a different culture, a different language, a tariqa I've never heard of in my life, you know. It's not like Qadri or Chisti or Naqshbandi. This is Halveti Jirai. What is Halveti Jirai? I don't know. Never heard of this thing before, you know. But I fell in love with that because absolute discipline. Absolute respect. The Sheikh says something, everybody follows. You don't have to say one thing 100 times. Absolute discipline. I'm not saying other tariqas don't do that.
Yeah.
But you know, it was absolutely something. I just fell in love with what I saw in Turkey. And I went back the second time and he gave me instruction. It wasn't, okay, I think I should do this or I shouldn't do this. Maybe I need time to decide about it. Maybe I'll come back and tell him yes or no. He didn't ask me that. He told me straight, this is an instruction for you for the rest of your life. There's no choice. Yes or no. It was a yes already. You had no choice.
You have
to follow through, finish. Because you came back, yeah? You saw the place. You came back, you know. You saw the place to give you an instruction. He told me, but he said, in your soul, I read as somebody who wants to help people. He told me that. before that. And I said, look, I trust this man implicitly. And then he told me, when you're going to build a hospital, you're going to have a lot of obstacles, but you will eventually deliver it. And I had tons of obstacles, and I eventually delivered it.
I was going to ask, you again, with so many projects, international and national on the ground level, you must come across countless problems and obstacles. What's the system that you use to overcome these things?
I love challenge. I get sad if there's no challenge. You know, I work on stress, difficult challenges, opposition, obstacles, drives me. As I tell you, I find relaxation very stressful. You know, I love a life of challenge. You tell me, let's go spend 3 days in a hot pool. I want to sit and cry. What the hell am I going to do in a hot pool for 3 days? You know, but tell me to run a disaster. I'm ready. All the adrenaline is running, kind of stuff. So you learn. But remember, all this accumulated learning, what I'm telling you is what I remember.
Yeah.
I don't know what other subliminal things I've learned over the years, you know, 32 years, and of course, before that, from childhood days, I can't tell you what it's there in DNA, it's in the mind, in the soul. So you just know that, of course, to answer your question, not partly wholly, it's fate. Mm. That whatever, the Prophet said that, whatever is going to strike you is never going to miss you. And whatever is going to miss you is never going to strike you. So what's going to happen is going to happen either way. It's not going to make any difference, you know. So you just got to accept it and deal with it the way it happens. And then, of course, I got fantastic teams.
Yeah.
And other things, I give them all their own independence. They're free to do what they want to do. And yet to the staff, we don't hold them back. Come up with your ideas. We allow everybody to grow. My son's got a teaching program. You want to study? You must please go and study. Finish your matric. Do this course. I got half too many of my staff studying here. He drives them to study.
So, Gift of the Givers works as an organization. What advice would you give to other people and organizations who want to help the communities?
Honesty, sincerity, transparency, no ego. You're not better than the people who need your help, because tomorrow you may need the help. Right? Not for that reason, but as an Islamic principle. Serve people with dignity. Show them love and kindness. And whatever you do, don't try to do 100 different things. Do a small thing, but do it well.
Mm.
Our policy is very clear, that when we go to a disaster zone, we say clearly, we're only taking one street. The rest of the disaster is not our problem. If you try to do everything, you'll do nothing.
Yeah.
So do something small. You decide, okay, I'm an organization, I'm going to help one house. Help one house all the time. Record it. Have your pictures. Today we have social media. We didn't have it in those days.
Yeah.
Put it on social media. Explain it. Make nice folders. Let people see it. People you trust, go to them. You know, and slowly, you'll do two, and then you'll do three. And eventually, the people themselves will be talking about how they received aid from you. But you must focus your mind that you're going to start a small. No, I'm going to help 1,000 people today. You haven't helped one, but you're going to help 1,000 people today. And you'll fall flat within the next 5 days because you'll suddenly think this is not possible.
Then, I'll say to wrap up. There's a lot of talk online of would you ever run for president?
It's easy to answer because the Sheikh already told me that in 95. He could see the future. In 95, he told me, you will never get involved in politics. Mm. You will never work for government. You will never work inside government, but you will always work with government. Mm. And you'll notice for 32 years, we've been working with government from the outside. Never from the inside. Yes, they engage us, we engage them, we talk to them, we give them ideas, you know, we have discussions all the time. Ministers call you, the presidents call you, deputy presidents call you, political parties call you, corporates call you, big companies call you. But clearly in 95, that's the first thing. And I understand it very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you work with them, nobody inside government can make a decision. They got like six people above them got to sign and nobody can sign.
Yeah.
People are too scared to put their head on the block. You know, they're too scared to make a decision, to be decisive. I'm thinking, I'm going to be in government, I'm going to have this process. When the hell am I going to deliver anything? No, you can't get anything done. Outside, you're very, very influential. You can get things done much faster. There's no rules, there's no red tape, there's no bureaucracy. And I specialize in breaking rules. I get things delivered, bypass government rules, and nobody tells me anything. I just break their rules and I do what I want to do, and nobody stops me. In fact, at times they called me, they said, can you break our rule for us? You know, it's that kind of story, because they said, we can't do it, only you can do it. And it's that kind of stuff where I get Yes, the whole country has asked me wherever I go. Even they call me Mr. President when I walk in the streets. In Parliament, they call me Mr. President. The political party guys call me that. You know where I go. I said, you know what, thank you very much, but no thank you.
Not touching politics at all.
The family said, no way. I'm doing this from the age of 28. You know, I have brief gift for the givers. I've wrecked my family life up. From the age of 28, what chance did my kids get to see me?
Yeah.
I've been traveling like crazy. Inside. I stopped traveling outside the country now for the last 5 years since 2019. And I started focusing a lot on the country. I've only done 2 international trips in that time.
Wow.
Yeah. One is from July 2019. I did one to Yemen last year. And I did one to Turkey before the earthquake, because the third Sheikh came, my second one passed on.
Oh.
So according to the third one, I went for that.
And then what are your aspirations for Gift of the Givers going forward?
I want to see development, you know, in every way. Because from what I was speaking to you, we've gone into infrastructure, catch-up surgery, water wells. We've done, you know, we do lots of development. I want to see peace, you know, I want to see growth in the African continent. But in this country, I want to see our health systems come into place where the catch-up surgery is done. We have enough trained manpower. We need to fight unemployment. We need to fight crime. We need to make the place place for tourists. Tourists bring lots of money for the country. Mm. You know, we go to Cape Town, it's full of tourists. Mm. You know, they're still coming. This is not a failed state. I want people to go back to faith and spirituality, because the only form of positivity and hope is faith and spirituality. There's no other way, because that's what keeps people going. You know, and every talk I've done, when I speak about that, you would think people were secular, they'll be offended. And you'll be surprised, all the secular people who've moved away from religion want to know more about faith and spirituality and how can we get back there. That lady who lived, survived the earthquake, what kept her alive for 8 days? Faith, but spirituality.
Really?
Komani in Queenstown, our truck is coming at sunset in winter. An old lady comes out of the house on crutches. She looks at the truck, she looks heavenwards. You didn't let me down. She was asking for food. Nobody else to give her food. She just asked upwards, and then the truck arrived. So faith and spirituality is key for us as individuals in the country, whether it's government, corporate, trade unions, professionals, parents, kids, whatever religion, sports. We need to build faith and spirituality and honesty and integrity. Mm. When it's spirituality, morality, values, and ethics. If the country develops that, we won't have to worry about stealing money. Nobody's going to steal money, because you're going to be policing yourself.
Yeah.
And once you start policing yourself, you'll make sure that every cent is spent the right way. You, as an insurance agent, you won't lie and sell the wrong package to the people. As a doctor, you won't give the wrong medication and charge for medical aids 4 times what you actually did. You know, and a lawyer won't rip the people off and won't steal road accident fund money and trust money. And his husband, brothers and sisters, that's a big problem. They do each other down in estates.
Yeah.
You know, so you talk about this religion and you go to Umrah and you go for Hajj and you pray 5 times a day. Those are the easy things. When it comes to the real policy of sharing the money, of being honest, of being truthful, of giving the people a share, sorry, that you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
So go back to values, not about the prayer.
We need to bring back community.
You bring back principles of ethics. And corporates say governments are corrupt. And I ask them, who corrupted government? It's you guys, you know. So don't have talk about the pot, you know, calling the kettle black.
Yeah.
Change your system. And people have embraced that idea. The important thing I want to say is there's no need to fear. This is a great country.
Mm.
We're not going backwards. We're only going forwards. But we all need to do this together. Stop saying it's a job of government. Government, 7.4 million people in Texas, can't look after 65 million people. It's impossible, no matter what the government is. It's impossible.
Yeah.
We need to do this together. My final message is, take the branding off. Take out the labels. Take out the uniform. Let's all of us go stand in Greenpoint Stadium in Cape Town. All wear white or black, whatever color you want. Right? No branding, no logos. You won't know who is who. You won't know which, whether it's the government, political party, corporate, trade union, imam, priest, nothing. We all got the same clothes on. The only thing that you will know is that all of us inside here are South African.
Mm.
And if there's a problem here, who's going to solve it? Me alone, or we all going to work together?
Yeah.
You're going to work it together. And when you're going to work together, you're going to solve the problem much faster than trying to work it alone and working against each other. So when you work together, what do we need? Food, security, school, hospital, healthcare, development, fighting crime, faith, spirituality, human rights, justice, all that kind of stuff. And we are the only ones who can do it for ourselves. Those guys bad-mouthing the country, those who are mouthpieces for foreign governments, yeah. They are political parties, and they are media editors and journalists who are mouthpieces for foreign governments. You don't belong here.
Yeah.
This country is our country. Be a patriot. Worry more about your country than worrying about soldiers to go and fight in Israel. Yeah. You know, go, please leave, all of you go. You know, you've got negative things to say about the country. Please leave. Nobody's forcing you to stay here. Leave, go. We don't need you here. You know, we need people who love this country, who's nurtured us, who's taken care of us. Make your input. Stop complaining. Let's fix the country ourselves. It's our country. Let's leave it as a great country for our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren. Be committed to your country. This is where your life came, where you developed from. And this is a message to all young professionals. Let's sit together and fix our country ourselves. We got the skills. Put the time and stop complaining.
Yo, shukran. That was amazing. Like, I also think that's a message that must go out on its own. Mm. That we need South Africans to look after South Africa, yeah. Not just the government.
No.
Shukran for your time.
Remember, the people who don't have the jobs now, they've been disadvantaged pre-94. They were stopped from learning, from studying. They were not given skills. They were not empowered. Now you're complaining about them. But those are the same people you deprived in the first place. What are you talking about? Yeah. No, they're all stupid. They can't do anything. You put them in that position.
And also, offer them skills and positions where they can better themselves. Offer them the dignity to be people again. So, I'll say people at work and function within the community as well. Because many times I feel like when people don't have purpose, they feel lost and they end up not helping community.
And they go the way with me.
Yeah.
And there are so many people ask, look, we don't want to hang out. Please give us a job.
Yes.
Please give us a job. We want to do it for ourselves. There are so many kids crying out for them. I told corporates, you know what? Take apprenticeship. Give kids an apprenticeship. Give them a stipend. You will empower them. You will give them dignity. You will give them self-esteem. Even if 2,000 men, let's take care of a family of seven. There will be no more hunger in that house. You know, it'll take the pressure off the social grants. It will help us develop. Whoever can create jobs, empower people, please do it. As a country, we need to do that collectively.
Shukran for your wise words of leadership and of guidance and of spirituality. But also, shukran for all the work that you do within the community and for the world. We genuinely appreciate it. And thank you for your time. I feel like you were a very busy man, so we appreciate that as well. Do you have any final words, Prof?
No, I think I've said everything.
Shukran for joining us today. This is the Muslims Connected podcast. And today we were joined by Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman.